And just forgive me if there's a silence or anything. It's just me looking at my questions to make sure I've covered everything.
Sure. Yeah.
So how would you describe your present line of work?
So I'm a game developer. I do all sorts of things related to that, and also running a home business around creating games. So I wear all sorts of hats, but the main thing I do is design and program and distribute free video games.
Okay. And is this a strictly solo project, or is there anybody else involved?
No, I grew up with my brother doing programming games since we were little kids. I don't really have any memories that don't involve writing games. There's pictures of me like crawling up onto my dad's lap and stuff and writing little basic programs with like little for loops moving things around and stuff. So my brother and I have been doing it forever, and he's kind of dropped off the programming duties. But we design the games together, and then I write them.
Okay. And so as I understand it, Dwarf Fortress is y'all's project right now.
That is the current large project that we're working on. We've got other projects that we work on that haven't been released, and we've had projects that we've done in the past, but the main one that we're working on is Dwarf Fortress, and it's the one that's keeping us afloat, basically.
Great. So before I ask you about that, looking at your side, I see quite a few other games. Can you give a brief rundown of other projects that you've worked on?
Sure. Yeah. The I started the site in December of 2000 when I was in grad school, and the first game that we started was Slaves to Armok, God of Blood, which was just a fantasy game that never really got off the ground. It had the same idea as Dwarf Fortress, but it had more graphics to it. And while I was working on that, I'd take breaks to produce other little games that are, a lot of them are based on ideas that we had when we were kids or just things that could be knocked off very quickly. So none of the other projects up there are things that even we really took seriously. There's a little arcade game called World War I Medic that we wrote in 2 days. But, I mean, it made it in a magazine just because it's slightly novel. Idea, and then there's another little joke game we wrote over a couple weeks called Liberal Crime Squad, which is a text game. Those are the two sort of main projects that anyone ever talks about, even though they're just little games. And then there's a whole slew of little arcade games. They're all text-based. And another group of arcade games that use 2D graphics, and those are sort of the sub-games, which are just things when you have some kind of sick little idea that you kind of want to air out of your head. I put those up. Those are all kind of tragic, though. And all of them are produced. All the sub-games were basically produced in a day or two. We've written large projects in the past, but it's difficult to complete a large project, especially when you're younger and you have little experience. So this is kind of a fraction of our output, but it's all of our public output.
So would you, I guess if they only take a day, they're not really projects per se.
Well, I mean, it depends on what, I mean, a lot of songs are produced in a day, a lot of poems are produced in a day, and, you know, whatever you call them. I mean, basically the entire process that's played itself out for Dwarf Fortress, aside from publicity stuff, played itself out there. They needed to be designed. They needed to be programmed. There were discussions about them. So it's really just, in a nutshell, it's the same thing going on.
Mm-hmm. Is there a division of roles between you and your brother in the development of Dwarf Fortress?
Yeah. Well, I mean, it depends. We've got different ways that we write up the that we think about our ideas. I mean, oftentimes we'll just sit and talk. Just talk about, you know, would this be good to have in the game? Would this be good to have in the game? But we've tried out different ways to design the games. One of the ways that's kind of unique that we designed the games is that we'd write stories, and this is mainly my brother would write these stories about a theoretical. I mean, there's a portion of the game that's a role playing game, and so it works for writing, say, a story about a character going through what you'd want to happen in the game. It doesn't necessarily need to be supported by the mechanics very well at the time. You just write a story about what you'd like to have happen. So somebody going off and doing something that you can't do in the game, but that you'd like to have happen in the game. And if you've got a story, then you tend to think about related things that happen. Like if someone goes somewhere, you could describe where they've gone, and then you could describe the characters they've met, the conversations they'd have, and places beyond that, and the things that happen. And when you're paying attention to details like that, then you can go back and look at the story and analyze the different mechanics that have come up. And so he does that portion of it. We kind of go through the stories together, but he'll write them, and you know, without direction from me or anything like that, he'll just go and write them and do what he wants to do. And we don't really have disagreements about content because we've been doing this for 20 years. We kind of have the same idea about where the game should be going. Whereas when I'm planning stuff out, you know, I'll just generally think in more traditional terms about what I want to do in the game. So we both design the game, but we have there's essentially a division of roles there in the way that we do it, and we have tasks associated to writing these, like handling these stories. We post them online, and we post the analysis of the stories online, just to let people see what we're doing. And then as in terms of other tasks, we've got the actual programming of the game. I basically do all of that myself, although if I need kind of a sounding board for a difficult algorithm problem, then he's usually the person for that. He has some experience programming, but even without that, it's useful to have someone to talk to. And then there's also the other parts just surrounding the business part of the game. I don't know if you're that interested in that kind of stuff, because there's a whole division of labor there as well.
Sure. Does that require a considerable amount of time?
No, it takes several hours a day just handling forums, handling email. You know, you've got to do your taxes, all that kind of stuff comes up, and interviews and that kind of thing. It's like I'm basically the PR face for Bay 12 as well. I do almost all of the interviews, and I used to do more of the forum work. Now my brother Zach has expressed an interest in doing some of that. In part to free up some of my programming time. So he's handling, you have to handle moderator reports on a forum, right? Because people can't really control themselves sometimes, and you need to steer them in the right direction. And so he spends time on that, and that can take, you know, an hour a day. It depends on how active things are, as there's several hundred people on our forums, and they don't always get along. And then there's the whole posting all of the development logs. We have a very open process, not in terms of the code, which is all closed source, except for certain portions that we've worked on with other people. We'll probably talk about that later. And then but just in terms of the design, we've got basically everything except for the minutiae of how things work in terms of algorithms and so on is all just posted online, and I update that as well, and I'll spend, you know, another, say, half hour a day just sorting through my notes, and this is the notes, the sort of the joint notes from planning that just get thrown on a tablet or into a text file when we're doing it, but then I've got to put those into the computer In a format that can be digested by people. Well, arguably, I mean, I don't know how effective my notes are at really bringing everything across that I want to post them online, but certainly better than scribbles on a tablet. And then I generally put those together and post them. We have HTML files and Python scripts that produce those files and that sort of thing. So.
And those files, just to clarify, they're the algorithms or the prominent pieces of the code you've been working on, and you're communicating them to your fan base?
Oh no! I think we got flipped around there. The game itself is closed source, and I'm giving them everything but the algorithms. It's like they know where the game's going.
Okay.
They know. They have lots of little specific things, and this is all available online. If you go to bay12games.com/dwarves/dev.html, it's all up there. There's 500 items that I call RECs, which is short for required items to do, which is just bugs. It's kind of bugs, but also little balance problems, that kind of thing. And there are say 500 of those. There are things that I call bloats, which are things that just extend the functionality of the program without being required. Just little features to fatten up the program. But that's kind of the most important part if you want to make a unique game. And there are several hundred of those, and then there's development arcs, which was originally something that I was planning to say work on. I have one, say, called the Army Arc, which is adding armies to the overland map and of the game and having them fight with each other and so on. And the Army Arc was originally going to be an arc of development, meaning that I'd work on it, complete it to my satisfaction, then move to the next arc. But it doesn't work out that way all the time. So I move between them now. But they're still called arcs. I've got these arcs of development. And I've got the core items posted, which are 100 things that are sort of really core to the game that need to be completed before I'd call it version 1. And we're on version 0.28 right now, which means that 28 of the core items have been completed, and there are 72 core items remaining. And those are all posted. They've got a paragraph up there, and they say which wrecks and bloats are related to them. That's all online. And then we've got my brother's stories online, the analysis of the stories online. We've got these other things called power goals, which are really short vignettes, say a couple sentences, saying something that we'd like to happen in the game. It's kind of a short version of his stories, and then each power goal would have two or three things that need to be implemented, and then that can be checked off. But most of our power goals have been related to things like in the stories that involve quite a bit of character interaction. So there aren't really any of them that have been checked off yet, because the character interaction is still something we're going to do. In a little while in the future. And that's a more new process that we've put into place. So that's the kind of thing that's online, but nothing that says, we need to create an array with the different cave types that are shuffled together to form a map and all that kind of thing. There are a lot of people that are interested in hearing about that, but it's something that it's basically a line I don't cross online in my development notes. I mean, if anyone sends me an email and says, "How'd you do this part?" I tell them. Mm-hmm. And if people want to talk about it, I tell them. But I don't want it all in one place. I just don't want to release the source code because I'd be driven out of business, basically.
Do you have a lot of emails of folks inquiring about a particular part of code?
Not a lot. I mean, I'd get several a month. But it's not like something where I have to empty my inbox every day saying, there are 10, 15 emails. I mean, I get, say, 15 emails a day. And the emails I get, say, two or three of them are just going to be related to donations because we have a system where we reward donors with stories. My brother will write these reward stories, which are similar to the stories we put online, a little bit shorter. And we also send them crayon drawings and so on. So there's a bit of traffic related to that. There are things like setting up interviews and stuff, maybe be one or two others. There's people that will just ask questions about the game and how I'm doing and what I eat and stuff like that. And that's like two or three more of the emails per day. And then there are people saying, you know, why don't you do multi-threading? Why don't you do this? Why don't you do that? There are a number of technical emails, and that's going to be another two or three. And then just other I can't think of anything else off the top of my head. Other categories that they go in, I'm sure there's other things that they talk about.
So I would say that Dwarf Fortress is very playable as an alpha, but can you give a summation or explanation of what kind of game Dwarf Fortress is?
So it aspires to be a fantasy world simulator, a single player game, in the sense that you could just press a button, create this fantasy world. It's got 1,000 years of history. It'll do that right now, and then you'd ideally be able to take up a role there. Right now, you can be an adventurer who's just a person that wanders around causing trouble, or a dwarf fortress, so a colony of dwarves mining into the mountains. But ideally, you'd be able to control any other object in the game and just, you know, do your thing, do whatever you want to do within, you know, the power of that object, and then see how it changes the world and interact with the world and so on, in a kind of a persistent way. The world hangs around afterward, so that you can change it and continue to change it and continue to change it and so on. Basically, in a way that's only visible right now in things like MMOs, the massively multiplayer online games. But there's a lot of things about those games that don't really mesh with a single player experience, which is why essentially we've always stuck with the single player model. Although we've been planning this game way before MMOs even existed, there were MUDs and stuff around, but we never played them, so it doesn't really have anything to do with the design inspirations. But they end up being quite similar. In that sense. But right now, the game, of course, doesn't have a lot of... I mean, it keeps track of the histories and so on, but there's not a lot of interaction between the world elements, which is kind of what we're working on alleviating right now with the next couple of releases, starting with the army stuff and then the caravan trading and then diplomacy. You'll be able to interact a lot more with the world, and so it'll matter more. Although people right now will go on and they'll generate a world and then just read the histories and write up, post these giant stories about historical figures they've found without even playing the game. Because you can go into this thing called Legends mode and just look up what's happened, and it's pretty cool. It's working out well so far.
Yeah, that's fascinating. And one thing I wanted to ask about was the legacy type of gameplay that, as I understand it, where one player will run a fortress for a while and then pass on that world and that fortress to another player, and they'll run it for a little while and they'll talk about what they did with it and so on. So as I understand that, it kind of turns it into a semi-multiplayer type of game. Was that something you anticipated?
We had thought that might happen, because there is a phenomenon basically online of things like succession games that they do with other games, and Let's Play, which is where you get a bunch of people involved, right? They'll start a fortress, and they'll just take on our forums, say, but it happens on forums, many forums throughout the internet now, where they'll start a fortress, and then they'll just, you know, first come, first served, who wants to be this dwarf, who wants to be this dwarf, and they'll name their dwarves after them. And then just give people updates as they play, and as new dwarves migrate to the fortress, they'll take on more people from the forum, and everyone will just be really excited about what's happening with their dwarf and so on, and make little requests about what their dwarf should do. So that became multiplayer in that way. It's multiplayer in the succession sense that you're talking about, where you take a fortress and then pass it along. But it's also one of the main interactions that we have in terms of the sort of persistent world is that if you abandon your fortress or your fortress dies off, you can bring in an adventurer to explore it and kill monsters there and take treasures out of there and so on. And that's another way you can have a succession is to have someone play through a fortress and then post the map online or post the whole world online so people can download the world and then play adventures and go to that fortress. And they won't know the map of the fortress. They won't know where traps are. They won't know where objects are and so on. And they won't know what that lever does when you pull it and so on. So it's another way that they play. And I mean, there was an idea. It kind of fizzled out, but it's the kind of thing that they do is because it was a bit ambitious, would be to take a region of the world and put little teeny fortresses kind of filling up the entire region. They got several placed, but then it petered out, as these projects tend to do sometimes. But it was going to be called the Adventurer Park, where they set up little fortresses that had a theme all next to each other. And when an adventurer goes there, the adventurer can just walk through between them and so on, see the different things that are there. So there's all kinds of things that have sprung up, because naturally these days people tend to... A lot of people, especially on the internet, will tend to gravitate toward a kind of multiplayer experience. And we, my brother and I, whenever I say we, that's usually what I'm talking about, my brother and I, just don't care so much about the multiplayer games. We just didn't grow up with that, and it's not something that resonates with us really at all. But we tend to help them facilitate stuff to the extent that we can without really changing the underlying part of the game or changing our course drastically. Because one of our main objectives was to create a game that we'd want to play and that we'd be able to play. Because generally, if you create a game that has kind of a standard linear storyline or something, you can't really play it afterward if you wrote it. So it's this is a game we can just sit down and play, because everything's so complicated and random and things pop up, you know, they call it emergent gameplay or whatever. Things just pop up that you have to deal with a novel situation just because there's so many mechanics that work together well, or attempt to work together well as we sort out bugs and put more stuff in. Yeah, so anyway, rambling.
Yeah, it's a really fascinating project. So to pull back a little, can you... outline a typical day at work for yourself?
Sure. When I get up has been different, but let's say the typical pattern would be to get up at 3 p.m. And I check my email. I want to kind of get all of the communication stuff out of the way first so I can have clear sailing ahead, because when you're programming, you can't really tell all the time how long you're gonna work on something, or how much you'll be motivated, or what kind of role you'll get on, basically. So I wanna have a clean day ahead of me. So I get through my email, I read my suggestions forum. I've got the forum where they can post suggestions, and you know, having put a suggestions forum online, I feel obligated to read everything that's put there, or you're wasting people's time. So I read every thread on the suggestions forum. And then I do bug reports, reading the bug reports forum. And there's, you know, right now it's slowed down to about 3 or 4 or 5 reports a day, and most of them are duplicates or invalid, so it doesn't take that long. But when we're in the middle of a release cycle, the bug reports, you know, you can get 50 posts a day, and they're all valid. So it's the amount of time that takes depends on the cycle. But right now I'm in a pretty quiet cycle for bug reports. And then I get through that stuff, and then I'll basically be at a position where, you know, I can feel like I can do a little bit of the web browsing that I do to check things out, my own personal hobbies, stuff like that, for an hour or something. And then my brother will generally call then, and we'll go off and go somewhere around town or back to his place or whatever, and do some planning discussions. Coupled with TV watching and how much it for a couple, 2 or 3 hours, and how productive that is depends on what there is to plan. Sometimes, I mean, we've got the project basically outlined I have enough to work on for 15 years. So, because I mean, it's easier to come up with an idea than it is to write it in code. So we have a lot there, but it's not planned out in intricacy. So usually, whatever I'm working on or whatever we're about to work on, say a month or two later, we'll have a lot to discuss still, even though there's an outline. And so we'll generally talk about that stuff, or we might talk about our roles on the forum, or we might talk about, you know, there's a lot of things to talk about. So we'll generally talk that out, or watch TV, or both, that kind of thing. And then I'll get back home, say, after all this is done, I haven't actually programmed yet, right? So it's like I'll get home either, you know, 9, 10, 11. This is after having been up for 6, 7, 8 hours. And I've done work, but I haven't done anything that's going to move us closer to a release, which is all that matters in the end, getting a game up. And then I'll basically just program until 7 a.m., something like that. So that's 6, 7, 8 hours a day just doing the programming. And then there's all the other stuff. But basically, I mean, I just moved to this town a year ago. I don't know a single person here. I don't have anybody here or whatever. So it's like I'm just devoted to this project right now. So basically spend all my time on that. And there are days when my brother's busy. He has a job. He works part-time. On the days that he works, then I basically spend more time programming. Or if he has something else that he's doing, then, you know, you just basically cut out the part where I was, you know, designing with him and just turn that into programming instead. And that's basically how it's laid out. And of course there are things like this where, you know, I'll do an interview for an hour, or I had this podcast interview for some kind of anime site that talks about video games too, and we just talked for 3.5 hours about the game. And you know, that's just another thing that I end up devoting time to. So I mean, it's not like I have a set schedule each day, but it generally falls out like that.
Okay, sounds like a pretty packed schedule.
Yeah, it's as packed as I want to make it, right? I mean, it's when you're in a position where you're not working for other people, you can overwork yourself still. It's like I've got more already to do as far as this game, because this game basically can take as much time as you put into it, because you can always add more stuff to a game like this. And then there's other games, right? I mean, we have other projects we're working on. And those can take as much time. And I basically got, if I want to program for the rest of my life, I've already got an outline for it. So it's just a matter of prioritizing at this point, sorting out what we want to do. You know, of course, you can never tell what computers are going to be like in 20 years. But since one of the advantages is because my game is already so retro, it's like we can't really be left behind because we're already way back there, and people don't care, right? So it's like if you've got the game to hold it up, you don't have to worry about the graphics, and it's convenient for sort of future proofing yourself or whatever. Yeah, I forgot what the question was now.
In terms of video, in terms of the game development and design, what would you say that you make in a day or a week or a month? What products or documents come out of your work?
We've got let's work with a week, I guess, or if, unless you want me to do them all, I don't know what's in your question specifically, I produce, the main thing that I produce, of course, is code, right?
Right.
There's the code for the game. Mm-hmm. There's also the planning documents will generally just be on a tablet. We'll just sit with a tablet. You know, right now we've been doodling pictures of caverns and how things might be situated, so we talk to each other a lot. Write things down on tablets, and then I'll translate my tablets into my own text files, which includes, it's just a list of things I need to do. And right now that text file for this single release, is about 2,000 lines, I guess, just lines of text saying you need to do this, you need to do this, this might work this way, this might work this way, just sort of notes for the coding. And then also, if there's longer term planning, then what's produced for that are XML and TXT files that that then get that get translated by that Python script I was talking about into my HTML files, and the HTML files are all public on the site. Mm-hmm. And those get updated not every day or every week, but those get updated quite a bit. And so there's not anything in terms that you might get from talking to other people, like they might have a clay model that they scan with their lasers and it turns into a 3D mesh and so on. There's not really a lot of output like that anymore. I mean, I made the song for the game, for instance. There's a few guitar things that are in there, and I made those a couple years ago, and just played them, recorded them into the computer, and then that was that. There are also things like all of the auxiliary files that go with the game. There's these things that we have in what we call the raw folder, because they get processed into game objects. So there's all the creatures and items and civilization definitions and color definitions, material definitions, all that kind of stuff will constantly be updated as well. And those are sort of these auxiliary text files, and those come with the game. And they're also the font, because it's basically a text game, the font hasn't been updated for a long time. But that's also distributed with the game. Although people make tile sets, there's a whole modding community surrounding the game, makes tile sets, makes those raw files and so on, and those are all distributed all over the place. That's another thing that's up with the game. And there are a few other text files that are distributed with the game. And then there's the kind of business type things that are distributed with the game, like the README, copyright information, that kind of thing. But mostly just in terms of like one day, like what might happen today. Today we'll have tablet discussion. There'll be code written. My brother works on stories, so he's writing a story now that's 10, 15 pages long. It's a fantasy story. He'll write that out on a TXT file on his computer. And then, I don't know if he's using a word processor. I think he just uses Notepad, but he could be using Word or something. I don't know. And then we'll go through and analyze that, and that'll just lead to another TXT file that then gets HTML'd and thrown online. But since it's such a, it's kind of a technologically backward program in the sense. So there aren't a lot of complicated artifacts. Like the guys from Valve Software just invited me out to their place a couple days ago, and of course they have all kinds of crap there, right? it's like this is the guy, he's the editor on the Star Wars, the last three Star Wars movies, and now he's making movie trailers for us, and the guy just sat there, and they have all this technology and stuff and so on, but it's very different from what we do.
So, going back to the tablet, just to clarify, are these electronic or digital tablets, or are you talking about sort of...
No, these are just yellow lined tablets or white ones. Paper, just writing on paper. We were always fascinated by the idea of being able to kind of draw at each other on some kind of electronic tablet, but we just sit on a sofa and write crap out. I mean, it's not unlike the waste paper basket full of crumpled up papers that you might expect from a poet or something. It's just just that kind of planning document. It's all very low tech. But it's convenient because you can do it at a restaurant or whatever. Just sit there and scribble things out. So, basically my room always just looks like a big expanding cloud of paper until I clean it up. It's just all these notes, and then they just get refined and refined until they're actually turned into code and development documents and so on.
So I understand that there'll be eventually a lot of these. A lot of the work on the tablets will go into the HTML files, and they'll be posted. Do you keep the doodles and sketches and whatever you draw on the tablets yourself, or are they thrown away?
It's a lot of it's thrown away. It depends on the quality of the the artifact, right? Because sometimes you're just trying to solve a mathematical puzzle, right? I mean, I've got this piece of paper right here, and it's covered with doodles and garbage, and a lot of it is just Ended up being reinventing Catalan numbers once I looked that up online and trying to figure out facts about them because I was doing pathing, monotonic paths on a grid or whatever to try and do my dungeon generator. And so there's just these little formulas and so on. I mean, it probably turned out that way because I'm a mathematician by training or whatever. I was a professor for a couple of years before I decided to go write video games, and so there's just all these formulas splattered here. But there's also a doodle of a really horrible doodle of a cavern with some lava at the bottom and vertical connections between them and so on. And so this is the type of paper that will just get thrown away. There's no reason for me to keep this. I mean, it's got no information. Basically, the thing with the paper, it's got no there's nothing here that gives me any kind of nostalgic kick, where I sometimes save papers for that reason. There's nothing here that's useful anymore now that I've already coded all this stuff. This was just kind of a planning document for a development aid. And sometimes there's rhetorical questions on them. Like at the top of that page, it says, "Why ever mine deep?" Because we were curious about what would drive the players deeper underground to discover some of these caves that we were going to place down there. But, you know, why would they bother? And so we came up with a few reasons why they might do that, and then that influenced the design. But it was all just part of a discussion. And then once that got thrown into my TXT files online, then then that paper became useless to me. And the TXT files, of course, I've got a bunch of those because I DVD back up my computer every day. I'm not my computer, my programming folder. So I've got all my TXT files back for 3 years or whatever. And but as far as the tablet documents, they're mostly thrown away, although they're of course scattered all over the place too, and there's boxes of them and so on.
So you mentioned that you've been a math professor. Can you just give a brief sketch of your educational background, how you came to this present position?
Sure. So I guess we'll start at undergrad because high school is boring. There's just, you know, I mean, that's all typical. And then, well, of course, the whole thing's typical for a while. But so I went to University of Washington, and I got a BS in math there, and that's in Seattle. And then I was like, okay, I'll. It was sort of a path of least resistance thing for me because I always wanted to be a mathematician. Now, this whole time I'm writing computer games, but nothing's distributed. It's just a hobby. It's a hobby that's sort of consuming, but it's a hobby. And then so I applied for grad school, and I got into Stanford, so I went down there. And 5 years, got a PhD in mathematics there. And that was we were writing games. Dwarf Fortress was started at that time. Armok and the web page, the Bay 12 Games web page, goes up right at the beginning because I wasn't sure if I was going to pass my qualifying exams, which I failed the first time. And so I got the so I put up the web page a couple months after I arrived at Stanford, and maintained it the whole time I was there. I got my degree in 2005. And then I sent out 60 job applications and got one back. I got into Texas A&M, went up down there, and because there was a guy there kind of specifically working on the kind of thing I was interested in. I ended up getting into Rice later, but that was after I had already accepted the job, because basically there's this little hotbed of geometric measure theory and functional analysis people down there in Southeast Texas or whatever. So I went there and for a year. But being a mathematician or an academic in general is such a social job. It's like having to, I mean, especially, I don't know how much it is in the other branches so much, or the other departments and so on, but mathematics, it's like you can't really do it alone anymore. It's like you hear about these stories of people in closets and stuff, but that's really rare. It's mostly, I mean, you have to know what everyone's working on because there's thousands of people working and only, you know, there's only going to be one published paper on a given thing and you're all kind of pointing in the same direction. So, I mean, I don't know if it's most, but it seems like most papers are joint papers and so on. And it's just not, you know, it's just not my thing associating with others. And so I couldn't really handle it and my games at the same time. So I went into the chair at the end of my first year, and I was like, this was a month before I released Dwarf Fortress, so I didn't have any prospects for money or anything like that. And I was just like, you know, I'm done. And I was going to walk out that year, kind of give him my notice and leave. But he changed my contract, very nice to change my contract into a teaching postdoc for a year. So I got to teach classes and run my website, having released Dwarf Fortress for a year. And was able to save enough money so I feel like I'm not just, you know, walking on a tightrope. There's at least one net down there of the money I save for my job. But then I moved back up here in Washington where my brother is, and that was in 2007, I guess, in June. And since then, I've been doing this full-time. Kind of severed my ties more or less with the math community. It'd be impossible to get back in without writing another research paper or something. So yeah, that's kind of the whole adventure there.
Fascinating. So what would you describe as the essential skills you have now that come into play as a coder and as a designer and developer?
Yeah, so there are different skill sets, of course, required for each of those things, but it does complement each other. I mean, it's good to be able to design a game if you're going to write one, and it's good to be able to program if you're going to design because you understand the constraints, and you won't have just these wild ideas that are impossible to code and so on. But anyway, so for coding, you know, some of these things are hard to put into terms for me because, like I said, I've been doing this since I was a little kid. But I'm good at programming. I'm not great at it. I don't research every little newspaper or magazine article, internet article that comes out on the latest stuff and so on. So I'm kind of backwards ass. But I'm good at just good at that kind of thing. And the math skills definitely come into play there. Even in a game like this, I mean, they come even more into play if I were doing graphics, because you're constantly using matrices and linear algebra and so on there. And I've done that in games before, but the ability to kind of mess with symbols in your head and so on goes very far in programming. And so the ability to do that is very important. And as you move on up from coding to design, those things are still important, being able to understand the constraints that are on you, understanding algorithm complexity, what you can get away with and what you can't, and so on. And then once you get up to designing a game without thinking about the algorithm so much, then so you have to kind of break down, oh, what does it mean to be able to figure out if something's going to be fun or not, right? it's a difficult question for people sometimes because, I mean, I've been playing games for 25 years, and I know what I like and I know what I don't like. Certain things, you know, compel me and certain things don't. And every single time I played a game when I was a little kid, we'd always just think, how can I improve this? How can I improve this? How can I improve this? It was just how we started thinking about games. We started operating in spite of the games instead of because of them, just what we didn't like about them. And we're writing games, you know, since we were the kids again, we'd always have kind of these parallel projects, and then there'd be the games that we were playing, and they were very different. And so just having played a lot of games, you can recognize what works for you and what doesn't, and the ability to break something down from its overall presentation to its constituents, components, and thinking about what are the ways these are interrelated, what did they do, you know, how might they have designed this or programmed this or whatever. You kind of thinking about any game you play and understanding how it was built, and what decisions they made and what poor decisions they made, what was driving that process, and then how you might fix each individual one of those, and what would be a better way to write this game, and so on. Just to make it a more compelling and oftentimes just a less frustrating experience, right? That doesn't really come through in Dwarf Fortress because the interface is so crappy, but there's a reason for that, is because I'm still designing the game. I mean, Dwarf Fortress is also weird in the sense that I need to release it quite often or I won't be able to survive. So if there's, if I'm working on all of the underbelly of the program right now, all the guts of the program, you can't really have an interface on top of that unless you're burning a lot of time on it. And to have the interface there, to have it polished and presentable for an audience is not really practical, because if I had a polished interface designed for the game I've got now, and then I completely change something around, then I have to update the interface to get it back up to that level of polish again. So I don't do that. I just have something that's barely squeaking by for, say, 10% of the people that play the game, and 90% throw it out when they download it. I mean, it was funny. I went to the Valve thing, and the guy's like, "You do know that you could be making $10,000 a month, and you're just leaving money sitting on the table." I was like, "Yeah." It's like, because I just want to write the game, you know. That's more what I'm interested in than, because I don't have anything to do with money. All I do with money is pay my rent and get my food and stuff, and everything else just sits there. It was kind of the skills I developed as a grad student. I never really left that lifestyle or whatever. Just eating rice and bean burritos every day and stuff that I make, and it's kind of strange. But that in any way, in terms of the skill set and so on. I mean, the most important thing is to be able to. You have to have an understanding of what makes a game fun. That's a difficult question, and it's something that I understand more intuitively without having thought it out that much, just because I've been playing them all my life or whatever. But there's obviously ways to speak about that. It's just, like I was saying, it's hard for me because I don't accept that thing where it's like the guy's like, you know, where someone asked him, "What is jazz?" And he's like, "If you don't know what jazz is, you'll never get it," or whatever. I don't accept that kind of response. But it's something that you have to sit down and think about. It's like when you're doing linguistics and you have to think of the rules for your language, and most people don't know them, right? You can't do that without a lot of thought, and it's still an ongoing field. And the same thing with designing and a computer game that's quote unquote fun for a group of people. It's not, I mean, the same thing's not fun for everybody. I just write games that are fun for myself, and there's enough people that kind of agree more or less on our thoughts there. But But once you know, once you have kind of a feeling for what's fun for a large enough group of people, the main thing after that is being able to break something down into its constituent pieces. At least for us, as doing a simulation, there's also the different ideas of what type of game you're writing. Right? I mean, if you're doing a linear story game, then obviously your ability to control a narrative and produce a compelling narrative, even independent of understanding what makes a game fun, is important. Whereas that's hardly matters for us. There are bits and pieces where that comes in, where we need to design a story generator, basically, and we need to understand the components of a plot. But that's basically a simulation thing again. When you're doing a simulation, you need to break things down into pieces and then understand the rules that govern those pieces, and then put that into code in a practical fashion. That's kind of what drives a lot of our design. Anything that you might think about, things that people don't consider practical, like having a good conversation engine in a game, we're just going to kind of charge into it, break down what makes up a conversation, what makes up a person's motivations, and so on. Just put that in, see what happens. But rambling again. I don't know if you want to govern my talking a bit.
It's fine. Kind of leads into my next point. you've been developing for a while. Has there been a particular type of development situation that was, you know, especially good or productive for you? And if so, what characterizes that type of development environment?
I don't quite understand. It's something like my what the surroundings or the just everything about it, or
I mean, or, have you, in regards to coding, you say you might sometimes get on a roll. Is there, you know, environmental factors or a certain type of situation that's, you know, especially good for, you know, high productivity or creativity for you?
Yeah, because for me, it seems like part of the notions behind that question might involve like coworkers and stuff, right? And what type of hierarchical structure in your corporation helps you with your productivity and so on. And since I don't have a lot of that, the things I'd say are like, well, if I've got a you know, a well lit room, and I'm well fed, and I'm happy without having a lot of outside, you know, influences. Like having a crappy moderation day on the forum can kind of color my whole coding day or whatever, giving me a headache or whatever. Right. And it's just those kind of things, right? I need to have absolute kind of relaxation, no problems, no nothing like that driving me on. Although, sort of an element of challenge or competition or whatever can kind of get you fired up as well. Like I always program a little bit better when I hear about people doing something similar or whatever, and I'm like, well, you know, I'll just blow them out of the water or whatever, because they're operating under more constraints than I am, even though I'm just one person or whatever. I mean, it doesn't always work out that way, but because we make concessions on graphics and we don't make concessions on mechanics or whatever. So that's definitely a motivating factor at times for me. I mean, it's always good to see the little people's happy when you release your new version and so on. But that kind of thing. I've kind of carved out a good situation for myself here, I think. And there's not that much I'd want to change about it. I mean, basically, the only problem I've got now, which is of course a universal concern, is just, you know, do I have enough money to keep going? It's like, if I had to think about that less. Because right now I have to think about that. If I had to think about that less, then I'd be in an ideal environment, I think. Just able to do what I want, able to set my own hours, able to work just, you know, based on my biochemistry, I have different mood times and things that, you know, when I'm better at working on something or when I'm not. And I have the convenience being able to choose my own hours now. It was kind of the same thing when I was doing math or whatever. It's just there are times you want to think about stuff and there are times you don't want to think about stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, a lot of research is like that. And with me, I definitely noticed with math, you have to prep your brain, and then your brain does the work when you're not thinking about it. It's like you knock your head against the wall in a problem. It's the same thing with programming. You knock your head against the wall a long time trying to think about how to solve a difficult problem, and then the solution will just pop into your head when you're taking a shower or walking along the street later, because your head's been working on it. You just have to stoke the fire or whatever. And it's the same thing here. And so you need to have, the more freedom you have with your hours and the more freedom you have with the time that you think about stuff, the more you can massage that process and get it to match with your own particular makeup or whatever. Yeah. So, yeah, certainly, you know, not being in a 9-to-5 situation, not being in a situation where I have to respond to a lot of people in some kind of production pipeline where I have a particular role, is very, very, very useful for me.
Right. So I wanted to ask you a little bit about your code. As you say, it's a closed source, so you know if we bump into any kind of issues there, I mean that's
sure,
of course
sure.
totally fine. But can you say what language Dwarf Fortress is in? Are languages that you are familiar with?
So Dwarf Fortress is written in C with more and more C++ coming in. If there were a strict programming person, of course, would find that abhorrent. But basically, I learned a lot of my C++ while I was working on the project and found object-oriented stuff very useful, and have transitioned a lot of the program over to that. So it's kind of a hybrid now of C and C++. And as in terms of what else I know just a teeny little shred of Python. Most people wrote my Python for me, and that's used to produce my web pages. Mm-hmm. And I used to know BASIC when I was a kid. BASIC was the language of choice until I was 13. And then the summer, my freshman year in high school, or the year before my freshman year in high school, I don't remember, one of those summers right there, that's when I learned C, and then I dropped BASIC completely because there's no reason to know BASIC after that. So I couldn't program in BASIC anymore, most likely, but I used to know. And then there were things that I learned as a I taught all myself programming like that. But I took 3 courses in college because I wasn't sure quite what I wanted to do my freshman year, mm-hmm. if I wanted to go into math or computer science or whatever. And I found I didn't like computer science at all, really. I didn't want to learn, you know, I didn't want to write a compiler or anything like that, so I just didn't care about it. And but while I was there, I bumped into Lisp and a few other things. But it's not really anything I can use anymore. I don't remember the syntax anymore. And I took a couple C classes, but I didn't learn anything in college as far as computer programming.
So what's your workstation like? Are you developing in an IDE or
I'm using Microsoft Visual Studio Express 2008. Most of Dwarf Fortress was done on Microsoft Visual Studio 6, but then I upgraded a bit, and that was handy. Because it's just because of the optimizations they made, it made my code run 20% faster. So it's handy to use a good compiler. And I use that in particular because I like the debugger. Like a lot of people use things like GCC and G++, stuff like that, the kind of more nuts and bolts compiler. But I find it difficult to debug from those. And I don't know what other IDEs you can link on top of that. Like I know when you use the Mac, for instance, then you've got Xcode sitting on top of GCC or whatever, and that's probably just as useful. I don't have a lot of experience with Xcode, though. Some people ported. I released a game that was a gutted version of Dwarf Fortress, and people used that to port Dwarf Fortress to Mac and Linux. And now I compile on Mac and Linux, so I use GCC or G++, whichever one, on Linux and Mac now. And they built all those scripts for me. I don't really understand fully how they work. But it's got the game on 2 other operating systems, so I was happy with that. They just volunteered their time because they wanted to see it there. And I use MSVC. I don't remember if there was more to your question than that.
No, that covers it. In your code, is there any pseudocode that you provide in the way of comments or notes to yourself?
Although I mean my comments are not up to standards as far as, I mean, some people put a comment after every line, which seems kind of silly to me. Some people have good comments, and they'll have a giant comment before every function, says what the function does, what its inputs are and outputs. I just haven't found that very useful to me as a solo programmer. I can see why you'd really want that stuff when you're working with other people, and also why people use source control, stuff like that. I don't end up using any of that stuff. I do have comments, but they're mainly to remind myself about specific things. But I'm never really confused going back when I look at something, you know, 6 months or a year later, I choose clear variable names. I format my stuff according to a scheme that I can read everything, and so it's not a mess. It's not a total mess. That's of course going to be arguable up to people's standards, but I don't do a lot of the things that people don't like using magic numbers everywhere and stuff like that in the code that you just don't know why there's a 17 there or whatever. I give things long English names and so on. So yeah, there's quite a bit of comments in there.
Okay. So Dwarf Fortress is a very elaborate simulation. Is there frequent research that you need to do to implement the futures that are there?
Oh yeah, absolutely. I mean, take the geology for example. I didn't know much about that. I've always been fascinated by books that just have the pictures of minerals and stuff and talking about them. Those are little mineral guides. But I didn't know much about geology, and so but I wanted the rocks to coincide with reality a bit. So I went basically. People have joked that Wikipedia is a design document for Dwarf Fortress or whatever, because I just went through. I mean, I try not to use it all the time as a primary source because you never can tell, but I follow links from there, and MinDat was a good source for geology, the MinDat mineral database. You can punch up basically anything in there, and it'll show you a little picture and give you some information about it. And I did a bunch of research for when I was doing weather and the generator for things. So I've got rain shadows and orographic precipitation and all kinds of things about which way the winds flow to make different clouds. And I have all the different kinds of clouds and cumulus, nimbus, cumulus, stratus, blah, 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 blah. I don't remember what some of them are anymore, but I went through and did it properly when I was doing it. I've got cold fronts and all that kind of thing. And I knew some about that stuff, but I always make sure to research before. And we've even got someone now who volunteered to research ancient medieval medicine. And he's sent me some great summaries of the different things that came in, and that directly influenced my healthcare changes I've been making over the past months, couple months, and you know what was practical back then and so on. Because we have a general constraint. It's not something that we adhere to fully, but it's the basic idea is that anything prior to the 1400s is fair game for technologies and so on, and that includes more than most people think because there are some advanced civilizations back then, and you also kind of want to pick a model for things. So we're going to end up using the kind of 800s Arabian chemistry model because they did a lot of interesting things that seemed very dwarfy. But we're not going to use. We might have this as optional thing because a lot of people want to see gunpowder, for instance. Mm-hmm. But that's the kind of thing that's prone to cause arguments, and that's something where we don't care about it so much. So we're going to kind of have to go with what the undercurrents of the community are on that. But there's other things like there's an undercurrent of people that want steampunk, for example, right? They're interested in steam engines and Jules Verne type contraptions and stuff. And that seems kind of like a fad that's reemerged. So we aren't really interested in that. We weren't particularly interested in it. It's seen a lot of use in games recently. So we're just not going to do that, and things like electricity and stuff. And you always have people say, well, the electricity predates the 1400s because of the Baghdad battery or whatever, right? And it's like, no one knows what the Baghdad battery was for or if it would even work. And, you know, I remember they did a research thingy where they tried to hook up the Baghdad battery or whatever, and it produced less voltage than if you just used a lemon. So it's like the problem is not the technology. The problem is understanding electricity, and people didn't understand electricity, so we're not going to put that in the game, and so on. Well, I mean, you'll see electricity with lightning strikes most likely, though. And so yeah, but lots of research, And that goes back to one of those skills I was talking about when you're doing a simulation, is being able to take something like a Wikipedia article, which is just a summary of purported facts, and you can take that, find out what the core elements are, figure out what rules govern them, figure out how you're going to turn that into a structure in a computer game and algorithms in a computer game that are two things. You need them to be practical. You can't just, you know, have the thing. I mean, Dwarf Fortress is already chugging away as it is. It's very difficult to push more in there, but you have to be very careful. And then the other thing is you want what you're doing to end up being fun, and it has to intermesh with everything else you've got in there. But as long as you go down to small enough elements, then the rules are quite simple. And the things that arise from them, you don't have to really worry about corralling your emergent game player, whatever you want to call it. You don't have to worry about corralling it, because as long as you use rules and structures that jibe with reality, even approximately, everything's going to make sense. So you don't have to worry about it. And you'll also get all kinds of stuff popping up that you didn't even expect yourself when all these different things collide, and it ends up being really cool. But so definitely lots of research about everything. And everything that doesn't make sense right now is probably a placeholder because we haven't done the research yet. Or we have notes on the research a lot of times and just haven't had time to put it in. There's always never enough time to do what you want to do.
Do you keep a list of resources that you've used, books or websites that have been particularly useful for you?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Now most of it's just kind of linked into the planning notes. So what I've got, for instance, I have things I haven't added are like, you can tan leather, but you can't tall leather, and you can't use, which is a different kind of quote tanning process where you can use a mineral like alum or whatever to do that. And there's things like mordants for dyes, which help to fix the dyes to materials that they wouldn't otherwise affix to. And for that, I've got notes that basically break down what exactly it is I want to do with that, but next to a lot of the notes, they'll just be words in quotes. And the words in quotes, what that syntax means is go look at a Wikipedia article with that text. Like, type that word in and you'll go to the Wikipedia article that covers that information. And sometimes instead of writing notes, I'll just have a Wikipedia link or in addition to the notes. And then if it's not Wikipedia, because Wikipedia is kind of a springboard. I mean, you can't trust on things there, and you can't trust the article just not to say "but" the next time you go there or whatever. But it's a good springboard, and then I'll also have other links that are just full HTML links to things like Mindat I was talking about. Is that you find a lot of good sites through Wikipedia, and sometimes I do Google searches. Very rarely I will consult actual paper texts. Like I've got a book on the history of surgery, which I got. My mother's a nurse, and she had that, and it has a lot of interesting stuff that didn't make it onto Wikipedia, and that's the reason we've got these, or it's kind of buried in Wikipedia. It's not linked from any of the main articles, and you have to look up the specific word, and then it says this article is a stub, but it shows you a picture or something, and then that was how we've got our traction benches, and the fact that they had traction in the year 150 AD or whatever, and all kinds of interesting traction devices and so on that seemed very mechanical. And again, they passed the Dwarfy test. So now we've got traction benches and for straightening out compound fractures and so on. More research. Yes, for basically anything merits a bunch of research.
That sounds like a extremely expansive type of research project.
Yeah. I mean, you just keep. I mean, anything we work on, we look it up. And if when you've got that kind of broad mandate to research everything, you're never going to finish. I mean, there's more than you can program in. You can't really hope to have a universe simulator on a personal computer, but it's cool to have as much as you can, because when you're in control of the rules, you can put in all kinds of weird dwarves and dragons and stuff and have it still all make sense. And it's like, having that kind of control over that and then having a bunch of people play around with that and change it themselves and they all do mods for it and stuff. It's just all really cool. It's kind of what a lot of people, a lot of our fans wanted to see out of computer games. And a lot of it's the kind of thing that could have been done 20 years ago. It just wasn't the direction that people were going. Mm-hmm. There's certain processors. Processors are certainly a lot faster now than they were in 1990. But so there's certain things that you wouldn't be able to do. But most of what I'm doing isn't processor constrained. So it's just stuff that people thought might happen when you see the early games like Sim Earth, and these aren't really early games, but like 1990 or whatever, and Starflight, Sim Earth, that kind of thing. There was a direction games were headed that kind of petered out and died. Mm-hmm. If you want to compare something like Spore to the earlier game by the same guy, Sim Earth, there's a huge difference, and there's just less simulation going on in the new games. Simulations are mostly over with, except in the independent games. I don't even care about the simulation aspect of it that much. We were mostly just interested in getting a kind of fantasy RPG thing we could play, but it ends up, to get it up to the level you want so that you can play it yourself, you need to have a lot of simulation aspects in there.
Right. So... is there any research that you do in the way of programming languages or technological advances that occur that you need to research or learn about?
I do less than I need to do. For instance, the OpenGL, for example, things are always changing with graphics, right? So that wouldn't seem to be a problem necessarily for a text game like this, except I use OpenGL to display the text because there are problems with the pure text libraries in terms of writing a video game loop that you can go through reliably in real time, and especially if you want to use the mouse too, it's tricky because you can actually use the mouse in Dwarf Fortress on like half the screens, but it's an ongoing project, so it's like there are things like that where you need to be then linked into the newest technology. Because the second you start using OpenGL, OpenGL just got revised. And Dwarf Fortress's method of doing things got deprecated. So that means that although the language is still supported, the method I was using, it's not obligatory for a video card driver company to support it. And so what happened was that ATI supported what I was doing and NVIDIA did not. So that's why Dwarf Fortress ran 10 times slower than it should on new computers, on newer computers with NVIDIA cards, like the fanciest game card you can have. If NVIDIA put it out, Dwarf Fortress would suck. And so it was a problem, right? It was a problem. Things were running 10 frames per second on the title screen. And it was just printing text because it would go automatically to software rendering or whatever and not use a video card at all. And so what happened, I didn't even know about this. This is the kind of thing that I don't research. I don't think about that much. And, I would, but I don't feel like I have the time. Part of it is just a personal problem, just not having the interest in technology and that kind of thing. It's just not that interesting to me. So someone pointed this out, someone who was doing the port to Linux, who happened to be a kind of OpenGL guy. He pointed that out, and he's like, you could do this with Vertex buffers, and the new card would support it. And so he just wrote all that code for me, passed the copyright over to me, and now the new versions, which we're still testing out, these versions that are posted on the forums only, this kind of 40D2, 40D3, these kind of supplementary versions, use that new code, and it alleviated all the problems. Of course, it's got its own problems because it includes some of the code from the Linux port and so on, and it's not working on certain computers, and so there's this constant kind of work with the community to get that all those bugs resolved before the next major release so that I can use the new code, because I don't want to have to support the old code as well, but it looks like I might have to. And then I'll just have a bunch of versions, and I don't want to get into that mess, but that's, yeah, it certainly pays to pay attention to the technology and keep up to date with it, but there's only so much one person can do. Like all my time is spoken for basically. So it's difficult, but I definitely need to keep up with that kind of thing, even if I don't.
Right. So going back to the code, just very briefly, just to get a context for it, how large is the code for Dwarf Fortress? How many lines?
It depends on how you want to count them, right? Because the guy told me the army standard is to count the number of semicolons, which is a line ending. Mm-hmm. And last time I did that, which was, I think 6 months ago, there were 230,000 lines. In the folder, if you want to go by bytes, which is another way to do it, right? Because that just says how many characters there are. Mm-hmm. It's 12 megs. 12 megs of code.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah, so it's a big project for one person, but it's probably a pretty small project for if you're talking in terms of even a game like I don't know, Doom 3 or something, right? Because they have a ton of code that's just meant to not even do graphics, but just to support drivers from different companies and so on, and they'll have a test bank of 30 computers where they try out different equipment, and a lot of the code will be just devoted to that kind of thing, where I just have to be like, sorry, you can't play my game because you have a weird setup and I don't know how to support it. It's a lot of lines for me. So it's probably up to 250, 260 by now, I think, the rate I go. Add a couple thousand lines, a week or a day, depending on how good the day is.
Right.
And it's not necessarily good, right? There'd be a lot of good that came out of reducing the size by 5,000 lines just because I did something stupid or whatever. It's chunky though.
So looking at the site, you've got all these narratives and different levels of goals and. Like you're saying, the army arc and different size projects for the game. How do you know on a specific day, on a one day in particular, what you're going to do? What code? What part of the game you're going to work on?
Yeah. So for every release, prior to every release, and while we're kind of working on the previous one, we think about the next one. You have to decide on specific elements that you're going to include in the game. And for us, we start with the last few times anyway, we've started with overarching goals. The overarching goals this time was to improve the underground, because this came kind of out of a problem with the community was having for a while now, ever since I released the version with the Z-axis. That it's just difficult. Once you change from a two-dimensional world to a three-dimensional world, it's much harder to find stuff underground, just as kind of a mathematical fact, right? I mean, if you have a string sitting in a two-dimensional space and you draw your finger across it, the space, you're going to hit the string, right? It's because it's there. But if your string is strung through 3D space, like through a room, if you drive your finger, which is a mining dwarf, if you drive your finger through the room, you're never going to hit the string. I mean, you have to be lucky to hit the string. And so strings no longer work, so I need to change over to big swaths of two-dimensional caves, like these big, huge rooms and so on, so that people strike stuff, so you can find stuff underground. So that was one of the big motivators. So you just have to look at the community. What problems are they having? You have to look at your overarching goals, and we already had those written down, right? Like core. I guess the most instructive page here would be the future of the fortress, which is kind of we've got these layers of development, right? We have all of the things we want to do. We have the things we're doing for this release, but then I've got this other page, the future of the fortress page. It's the URL is baitfallgames.com/dev_next.html, and you can also get there just from my development pages. Go to the what's coming next part. And it's got a breakdown of, say, 10 of the core items. I maybe a little bit more. So not there are 72 core items remaining before we get to version 1. And we picked, say, 10 of those that were there's a lot of the planning and design for the next release can just come through a natural precedence. Like, you need to have armies moving on the world map before you can improve sieges, and you need to have armies moving on the world map before you can attack another site, and you need to have a basic diplomacy before you can do advanced diplomacy, and you need to have trade before you can do raiding merchant caravans. There's just things that happen naturally. And so we took the 10 sort of basic items that preceded the other items and then listed them out, came up with an outline that uses those core items, how they're going to be implemented, broken into 10 sections. And so we've got, on that page, I have an outline about 15 things long about how the army arc is going to work. I've got an outline 4 things long about how the adventurer skills, like hunting and so on, is going to work. Got an outline 10 things long about how caravans are going to work, and so on. And then what's on that page right now, there's 6 of them are colored yellow, and those are the ones that we're doing for this release. And so what's going to happen for the next release, we've already made the decisions pretty much about what's going to happen for the next release, and more of those will be colored yellow. A lot of them, the order is independent once you're at that stage, and then you just then it's just like, what do I want to do for the next couple of months? What's going to be cool? What's going to be fun for me to do based on what I'm interested in right now? What type of research I want to do? What type of things I want to program? And we'll select those and then do those. So this page here is going to be enough work for another 3 or 4 years probably. And that'll get us up to, say, version 0.4. And, I mean, we already we did the math out. This last time I was doing an interview, we did the math out for how fast I've been raising the version number versus how long it's going to get to take to get to version 1.0. And the answer was, we'll be there in 2025. And it's not, I mean, it sounds bad, but it's on the other hand, it's not completely unprecedented, right? Sometimes things take a long time. I mean, Spore was, they were working on that for 8 years before they released it. So if you think of Dwarf Fortress the same way, It just fits right into the kind of mold of a long term project. A little more long term, but because it's the main project we're working on, the main project we've been interested in since we were little kids. It's not strictly true. There are other projects, and we're also working on those. At the end of the month, every month we take a week off to work on other things. But the Dwarf Fortress is our main thing. So if I'm done with version 1.0 when I'm 47, then I'm just on schedule. It's all cool. And we're always releasing it, so it's not like people are suffering, you know, without the project or whatever. Now, you can't, like I was saying before, you can't really predict, other people, you know, some other project could come out and just blow this out of the water or whatever. In 20 years, that's certainly, you know, likely. I mean, you'd hope that something would happen, and so on. But there's kind of this, but in any case, we have a number of structures guiding what's selected for each release. Another one that we're going to use for the next time. So we've already decided that, you know, which 3 or 4 things we're going to pick off here for the next time, off of this Future of the Fortress page. But the other thing we're going to use is we have this thing on the suggestion page called the Eternal Suggestion Voting, and it lets people go in and add anything they want, just a new development item of their own choosing. They just type it in, and then anyone who has a forum account can vote. Everyone gets 3 votes. They can just pick any 3 things they want. And we've said already publicly that we will consider. Now, they're written up by these just a random people. So we're not necessarily going to put it in the game. If someone wanted to do something we don't think fits, then we're not going to put it in. But in any case, we're going to pick the top 10, and we're going to consider all of them. So the top 10 now are mainly just small quibbles that they have with the interface and so on, and so we'll address those. Even though, like I said before, doing interface work now is kind of a waste in a sense. There's also the whole matter of community relations and maintaining your donation base, right? So there's a balance to be struck. And so we'll do their top gripes. And another one is just to improve the underground. Another one is to improve guild structures and farming. There are various decisions suggestions that they have, and the top one has 477 different people behind it. So that's 10% of all of the forum accounts, and most of the forum accounts are inactive. So it's pretty significant. A group of people behind that, and that's just improving hauling. They want to use wheelbarrows and mine carts and stuff to move things around, instead of having the dwarves like independently have to move every single rock or whatever. And, you know, we understand that. so we're gonna attempt community suggestions. We're gonna do our own things that gets us pushing toward the army arc, and the adventure skills arc are the kind of the main things we're thinking about focusing on next time. And we'll just finalize those decisions when the time comes, which will be after the next release, and continue on from there. So, yeah.
Cool. I wanted to go back a little bit to your kind of backup/archiving practices. And if I understand correctly, in regards to the actual Dwarf Fortress code, it is backed up very frequently.
Yeah.
And would it be accurate to say that you could roll back to a previous version if that's something you wanted to do?
Yeah, anytime. Now, I'm not on source control like a lot of people are, mm-hmm. which is reasonable, especially when you're working with more than one person. I mean, I don't know how familiar are things like the CVS stuff and that kind of thing. A version control system to put your code into the system. Anytime anyone makes a change, they commit it to the system, and so it makes it easy to roll back and forth, and that happens all the time. I don't have that just because for me, I didn't want to learn the system, didn't really see a need for it for me personally. Although, you know, it's like anything, I'm usually a late adopter of stuff. So for me, I can still just pull out a CD. They've got dates on them. I can roll back to wherever I want to. And generally, I haven't needed to do that. But there are a few times when I've gone back and grabbed a source file that I needed because I screwed another one up so bad that I just went and grabbed the old copy. And I also use it just for backups because, I mean, my computer just died recently a couple of weeks ago, and I lost nothing. And that was good. And so it's like, it's the kind of thing where if you aren't thinking of it, and it's the sort of thing where you have to lose something generally before you learn this lesson. it's a difficult lesson to get a whole new habit, just like brushing your teeth, a whole new habit. Every single day I back up my code. And I've got them not just at my current location, but in case of like a fire or whatever, I've got some over at my brother's place and so on. I don't have any online backups because I don't know about the overall security of that situation. It's like if there's one single person decides that they want to download it, then it's, you know, the whole world's got it. So I don't keep any online backups. And generally, the game has proven pretty resistant to reverse engineering. I guess that's just difficult in general. Some people have made some utilities that take advantage of some reverse engineering they've done, and we've generally been pretty lax about that because it hasn't really threatened our support.
The webpage constitutes this huge development log, kind of. You know, as I understand it, that things kind of move from the discussions you and your brother have and whatever makes it onto the tablets, and then these come text files and, you know, in some form or another make it onto the website. Is the website backed up or archived in any kind of way?
Yeah. It's stored in the same. I have a mirror of the web page on my computer, and I just, when I burn my DVD, I just drag my programming folder and my web page folder onto the DVD, as well as some other text documents, and burn them. Yeah, no, it gets backed up every day.
And the tablets, they stick around as long as they're useful.
This is generally the idea. Yeah, I mean if you were, say, back when I was working on math, I just burned through tablets, right? You just write down a formula, write down some other stuff next to it. It doesn't work out. That piece of paper is pointless, right? You just toss it. Now that's mostly what happens here. There are sometimes when we have a diagram that's funny enough to keep or whatever, or something like that, and sometimes things just get thrown in a box. I mean, I just went through a pretty big throwing out of things because I got a new kitten, and you don't want to leave papers all over the floor. So I just picked up a bunch of crap that was laying on the floor and tossed it. And I've got old papers, I've got new papers, I've got some papers, but it's kind of an artifact of a discussion, really, more than something where you'd kind of hold it up as a hallowed development document, right? It's just like drawing stuff out. But I mean, I guess everything's interesting to you guys who are trying to figure out what's going on or whatever.
Yeah, it can be up in the air, but it's always interesting to hear about different processes for development. Your code is closed source. Can you tell me why that's the case?
Yeah. So there was originally a pretty big push from the people, the community people, at least a significant portion of them, to open it up when I started, because it didn't seem like, you know, it would necessarily be able to support me. And there's kind of a tradition. I said Dwarf Fortress is halfway what you'd call a roguelike game. I don't know how familiar you are with various things like that, but it's just a certain style of text game. And that genre has had a tradition. Pretty much all of them are open source. Not all of them, but pretty much. And so people kind of expected that, especially for a text game and so on, a hobbyist's game. It's something that is better open than closed, I guess. But we were trying to survive on this, and the reason for closing the source is, although there are things like copyright laws and so on, ostensibly to prevent people from releasing copies and altered versions and so on, practically speaking, they mean nothing these days. So it's like people could do whatever the heck they wanted, and there's no sense in diluting your game to the point where, you know, someone could download someone else's game or whatever, not recognize that you had anything to do with it, and either donate to somebody else or donate to nobody at all. And I mean, from an academic perspective, and coming as a former academic, I mean, it's like I have a pretty strong desire to open up the source myself, but to let people check things out, let people improve stuff, let people learn for their own purposes and so on. But it's just completely not practical at this point. Because I have no idea what would happen. It's like I could very well survive. You know, it could work out well if I do it. But why take uncalculated risk? I've taken plenty of risks with the game and with my own life and so on. But I'm not gonna do something that I don't know what'll happen. It's like I don't know. I have no idea. So now we have opened up portions, like I was talking about before. I wrote a game using a lot of the same code that doesn't include code specific for Dwarf Fortress's mechanics and so on, but includes the engine, and made that available for people to, so that we could have a port for Mac and Linux and so on. And that's all freely volunteered work and so on people did for me. And now more people are playing the game. We've got, you know, another 1,000 people on each operating system or whatever, and that's all cool. So I'll open it up when it doesn't threaten me, and when there's something to be gained from that, you know.
Right.
But I mean, it's not even cynical in a sense, you know, like ruthlessly opening up certain portions or whatever. It's just practical. Just at the, you know, I didn't see any harm coming to me from that. But yeah, no, that's the reasons for it.
So talking about the code, this may be a weird question to answer, but you know, when you're deciding about how to implement some sort of functionality or something, you know, and it has to be explicitly coded in some kind of way, I imagine there are a variety of ways to go about it. But how do you decide how you're going to approach the problem?
Yeah, so, well, I can hear myself now for a second there. I heard, yeah, it depends a bit on what it is. So I was just going to actually open up my my computer, and so I've got a portion here. So the latest, I thought it'd be more instructive to go through an example, so I say something useful here. So my next thing says for underground features, updating life for them. So that it says I need to add mushrooms to the like giant mushrooms to the underground layers, and I need to get the fauna to appear. So that's totally a design, like a designer's choice, right? It's like I want big underground mushroom jungles, right? So it's like, so how do you work with that? Well, a lot of it has to do with code that's already there, right? I mean, once you get started, I have to say, how do I get the life to appear? Well, I've got a region populations set up already that has overground life, so I figure, okay, I've got a framework in place. I'll copy that framework over to the underground layers, and use that, and just create a new biome definition. So for subterranean life, which already exists from the previous stuff, and use that to create populations of underground mushrooms. Then I've got my, I need to place the tree. So now I need to come up with a placement scheme for them. And then you have to think about a lot of things that are already in place. It's like, how does it conflict with existing structures? Like, you don't want mushrooms to be placed all over, blocking all of the passages and so on. So you need to have a check for that. So really, there's kind of an inventory, and this is something that's very, very tricky in a sense, and you make a lot of mistakes. You need, if you've got a complicated project and you're adding stuff to it, any system that tangentially touches what you're adding can break, right? It's like, so you have to watch out. You have to kind of have just a checklist in your mind and just sit and think about it. You know, what can break if I add a mushroom jungle to a previously empty layer underground? And pathing can break, and that's the main thing you think of. But then there's how do they grow up over time, and could they grow up under somebody, and do you want them to be close to water? There's kind of an aesthetic thing there where you'd prefer them to be closer to water sources. And so you think of how can I write a function to, and this I did this with trees previously, how can I calculate how much water there is in the area so that a forest near some water would get more trees than a desert or something. And so I've got these calculations for that. And it's just kind of checklists of things, but it's not something that you can do easily with a sort of rote approach. I could write a program that spits a bunch of like every mechanic in the game at me, and then I go through with a checklist and say, you know, does this impact this? Does this impact this? But that would be impractical. So you really, a lot of it's just feel and experience with that. But that's the main thing that goes through my mind when I go trying to turn my next development item into the game, is what is this going to impact? So how do I code solutions to those, to all of those impact problems? And then other than that, you just, you know, what structures do I need? I've got to come up with a structure that might be needed for this change. And how can I best, you worry about optimization a bit. You don't want to knock yourself out worrying about every little character. You're never going to release a game. But you need to worry about a bit about making practical decisions in terms of how fast is this going to run. There's a whole bunch of things that go through your head, but just like anything, any skill that you learn, you develop good habits and you make fewer mistakes, and a lot of things come out automatically after a while. So making like all the things about specifically, do I want to use a binary search or do I want to use linked lists and all that kind of thing. It's just, you can go by feel most of the time. And if you really need to use a profiler and stuff to check it out, you're probably, thinking too much at the early stages. Later on, you want to do a lot of that stuff. But at first, you just have to kind of make pretty good decisions about it and trust to experience. But I'm not sure if I've really answered your question as you want it or not.
No, that was a good answer. So do you and your brother have a sort of, would you say there's a specialized language in talking about Dwarf Fortress, this project, that you and your brother and the fan community use?
Yeah, well, I mean, there's it's just like any sort of niche community, words gain meaning over time. And there's, people can talk, people use acronyms, people use names of famous dwarves from old stories people told to invoke some kind of, image without, you know, an outsider totally wouldn't understand if people are talking about Urist or whatever, which is just one of the famous characters from someone's story like a year and a half ago. But they use that name all the time. People use HFS acronyms for hidden fun stuff and so on. You get these, I mean, it's very common in computer games, these acronyms that develop. And the acronyms become a language like that. But there are also things like the whole development scheme. People wouldn't understand what a core, rec, bloat, arc, power goal, all these words that I use. That develops also into the vernacular that we use, and but I'm not sure if that's going to be a property of any community. So I'm not sure if that's what you're gunning for. Or?
No, that's right. I mean, I'd heard of things like a cat explosion, and
yeah.
Of course there are things like for y'all's development, like arcs and things like this. So it sounds like there's. It would not be immediately lucid to an outsider.
Oh no, what's going on. No. I mean, it's and especially the. I think it might be even more true for a game like Dwarf Fortress, which has been around for a while and has kind of a continuing community than a kind of single release game that is around for like a month or something. So we have. I mean, it's around for longer than that, but the general spike in popularity lasts a shorter period of time. So we've had plenty of time to develop our own way of communicating about stuff. I try to use it less often in my development logs because of who I'm speaking to when I do that, and you've got to be conscious at all times of who your audience is. Right. But when I'm having informal discussions on the forum or something, then I'll tend to use acronyms like a lot more often and because it's easier to communicate that way. But I mean, even on my development notes, I use some programming acronyms like LOS for line of sight and so on that people won't necessarily understand. And that's I mean, I consider that a failing, really, because you should be clear.
Right. So how do you think of Dwarf Fortress in terms of your body of work? Is it the epic, the piece, or are there other projects? Oh, well, as you said, there were other projects going on, but how does Dwarf Fortress figure into it?
Dwarf Fortress is the most, as far as I can see it now, being 31 years old as of 2 days ago, this is the biggest one I'm going to work on in my life. Because I'm going to continue to work on it, and anything else that comes is always going to be less because Dwarf Fortress has had the most time. Now, if I stop working on Dwarf Fortress at some point, which I don't see, but you can never tell, right? It's still going to stand probably as my most important game. Now we have chances with the other projects. Some of the other projects have the same scope, but they just don't have the same time put into them. If things on Dwarf Fortress were to grind to a halt for you know 2 or 3 years from now, and these other projects were to take the lion's share of the work, then you know in 5 or 6 years after that, they could be seen as the larger work. That's certainly possible. But as it stands, it's certainly my largest project that I've ever worked on, and the most important project I've worked on. Time will tell if that statement stands, you know, for my entirety of my work or whatever.
Pretty close to finishing my end. But I wanted to jump back very quickly to the stories that you said you and your brother make to kind of brainstorm about the game. Are those, mm-hmm. As a matter of form or process, are those always put up on the website, or how are those managed?
Yeah, so originally, this was, I mean, we've been actually working on our big fantasy game under different names since 1993. And originally, say 96 or 7, we started this story thing just for that fantasy game. And we've used it on other games after that, but we started for the fantasy game there. And the way it started was just with the tablet, and we wrote, we'd each write a paragraph of a story and then analyze it, kind of swap the tablet back and forth. And that was how we came up with a lot of the original ideas for the game. And of course, at that time, we didn't even have thoughts about publishing it. So it's not just kind of a development gimmick or whatever that we're posting for publicity. But it's you know, the process that we've always used since that time. And none of those are public stories. I don't remember if we ever grabbed one of our old tablets and typed one up. It's possible, but I don't think so. We still have a number of those stories. And even on but now for Dwarf Fortress, since Dwarf Fortress has become more formalized and it has a web presence and a community, and we see the value of sharing the stories with the community, now everything that we write up in terms of a story will be publicized, along with the analysis notes for it. We even had an idea originally of, this was way back when we just released Dwarf Fortress, of letting other people submit stories for analysis, but we just don't have the manpower to do that, and there's also copyright issues. So, but it was, I mean, it would be an intriguing thing to do, you know, in a more free environment to have that kind of setup as well. But in general, all of the stories are released now. Although we have written a few for the projects that we're working on and the other projects, and those stories would probably never be released because they're the original stories. There's no publicity for those projects now because we wanted to keep them under wraps, mainly just so we don't have to create vaporware. It's like you don't want to. I mean, people will hype things and then not put them out, and we just didn't want to do that. Although in essence, they've become a bit hyped because of the secrecy surrounding them. So it's inevitable. We weren't trying to do that. That was not the goal, although you can see in advance, and we did, that would happen a bit, that people would be like, what's the month-end project? What's the month-end project? And now there's a bit of enthusiasm about it, even though they don't know what it is. So those stories that we're writing for those projects, we've got them, but they probably won't see the light of day. It depends if someone specifically asked or whatever. But after they get web pages, if those projects are released, then if we continue to think it's a good idea, based on whatever reason, to have a story set up for those as well, then we'll release those as well. So I guess the answer to the question is all of the old stories are just, I mean, they're essentially the good stuff we kept on the tablet, right? Whereas the new stories are, we try not to think in terms of sort of pleasing the crowd when we release the stories or whatever. But that, I mean, that's always going to, you always have this kind of cross-contamination or whatever you want to call it, where if you write a story now, you know it's going to go up on the webpage, so you're more self-conscious, right? It's like our other stories would have plot inconsistencies, they'd have typos and stuff. I mean, we try to keep everything presentable now, and I don't know if that influences content or not that much. I don't think it does. I mean, certainly you can't have anything too foul, but the game's not that bad anyway. I mean, it's not that disgusting, and in terms of foulness, it's I mean generally violent situations are permissible, whereas sexual or scatological situations are not, and we don't go there anyway, so it doesn't really matter.
And the bugs, as I understand it, the bugs are covered by a lot, to a large degree, by the fan community, and there's a forum for the posting. And is that pretty much how bugs are managed for the project?
Well, that's how bugs are managed for the released versions. Yeah, I mean, we do plenty of testing prior to releases, and I'm always ironing out releases. So I've got it set up. There's a benefit, I guess, of having a one-man programming team is I gather that larger industry people or corporations, or whatever, have worked out, you know, solutions for this, to at least several of the places have worked out solutions so that you can do iterative development, right? You try and have the thing in a playable state as much as possible. And so I always rather compile everything I've done, check it out, sort out the issues. And so although the game has a lot of bugs out at the periphery, with the strangest kind of interlinks between the mechanics and so on, it's pretty clean. It's pretty clean for a game, at least until the latest version, where there's some problems. But it's been pretty clean for the past couple of years. People have been very happy with it. People often remark that, you know, this is so stable for an alpha or whatever, and it has to be, because it's. I mean, in a sense, you call it an alpha, but it's really a released game that's constantly improved and changed. So I call it an alpha to remind people of their expectations there, that there's going to be swaths of the game that just aren't complete. I mean, you can't really do anything in adventure mode right now that's very worthwhile. So for bug reports, though, once it's released, then, yeah, the bug forum is the main place. I mean, I get reports by email and so on, but the bug reports forum, I usually just refer to the bug reports forum so that everyone can comment. And then I take the report. I read my bug reports, try to read them every day. If it's a valid bug report, then I'll write a short description of it, link to the forum, and put it on the webpage where I've got all my bug reports. And then when I fix it, I'll just change its state there, check it off, comment the thread that, hey, this will be fixed for the next release or whatever. And generally run it like that.
And so how are the bugs managed by yourself?
So once I get them in that list, I get them in the list, right? I've got a list of, say, 1,000 bugs, and 400 of them are open right now. I know there's software out there that lets you do this, but I kind of like doing it this way, and I don't feel a big time sink. I've just got a list of them. I know kind of which ones are the worst ones that are open, just because when you read the report, you're like, oh, wow. And it kind of leaves an impression. So I might put it in my planning notes for the next release, actually, like, definitely fix bug 247 or whatever, so that I remember to do it. And then generally after a major release, I'll fix as many bugs as I can and have several subsequent releases. Like right now, I haven't released for, I don't know, it's been 7 months. And that's kind of unusual, but there are these long patches. But once I put out this release, generally I'll do 5 or 7 or 9 patches or something. And then I'll also do some quick releases. I'll do 5 or 7 or 9 patches within 2 or 3 days or 4 days. And then I'll do over the next week then, or the next 2 weeks, there'll also be a few more to kind of capture the smaller problems as well. And I'll just pick from the list. Part of keeping me motivated for development in general is to change up what I'm doing. So I'll pick a swath based on one category, like doing all the flow bugs or doing all the AI bugs or doing all the map feature bugs. Once it's to the point, of course, you do the most severe ones, the most sort of crash, game falls apart, or your save is ruined forever. Those kind of bugs go first, and then the minor bugs, it's not such an issue. There's generally no real push or pull from the community about which ones get fixed first. So I just do them in large swaths to keep the game at a certain level of cleanliness, really. Just you don't want it to appear like a, you don't want to get your game to kind of get branded with a tag, you know, this is a piece of buggy crap or whatever. You just want to stay away from that, and that hasn't generally happened with Dwarf Fortress.
So I've pretty much gone through my list. I guess just a couple of questions, a little more open-ended. I mean, we kind of have this list of, you know, what we think might be something that collecting institutes would be interested in or that would be valuable to look into preserving or keeping around. But is there anything that, in your experience, is particularly important or valuable in game creation that would be good to have for people down the line?
Yeah, so whoa, I'm hearing myself again. but yeah, so I mean, it depends on your perspective. Like if you're talking, because there are a couple things that I find for people are important. Like if I wanted the future game designers, you know, what I want them to see, I just basically have a list of games I want them to play. So it's a difficult thing though, because a lot of them are from the 80s and you can't even play them anymore. They don't even exist anymore in some cases. And so in terms of preservation for someone from that perspective, from game design, there's almost no substitute, and that's kind of the big trick, right? Is what are the substitutes? Because you're not always going to have the game. Would sort of screen captures or video captures of the game itself be valuable? I think you can almost get the whole picture from those. There are things like the code, of course, but from that perspective, it's always good to have the code. You're not always going to have the code, though. And now, if it's in terms of, but if you're talking about artists and so on, screen captures can almost be enough, just a screenshot or whatever. If you're talking about musicians, of course, you want to record the music. There's all kinds of things that come into play there. Now, if you're talking about, you know, are things like these design documents, would people get anything out of seeing my tablets, for example? I really don't think so. I think there's a lot of curiosity there, but it's not. I don't think it's that important. Now there's things like I was saying, and one of the things I brought up earlier is when I went to Valve, there was all that crap, right? There's all that stuff, and I think a lot of that stuff, I can't really speak to it, and I'm sure you're talking to other people in terms of what they find valuable among all that stuff, because I've never had to use a 3D modeler from to create meshes and all that kind of technological stuff. I really don't have much to say. I'm sure there's a list of artifacts that are useful there and just not just artifacts, but just in terms of the technologies and so on. But in terms of preserving the specific video game, of course, it'd be great to have all those little models and stuff and just have that's probably the first thing as in terms of a person not interested in game design, but in terms of a person who's interested in playing a video game or in knowing about, say, like say you had the I don't know, Quake or something. The Quake Museum exhibit. I mean, what a casual museum goer would be more interested in is they of course they'd love to play the game. That if that's not practical, just having those models and stuff and you know all the models they used, the actual physical, you know, plastic or clay models they used, yeah, and that kind of thing is useful. Now, if you're talking about, but like I was saying, for a designer needs to see the game played. They need to see. Now I don't know in terms of like actually hearing like what in terms of the designers of the future. Again, it's like if people need to like, because it's kind of strange thinking about transcripts of conversations and stuff, because I mean, people naturally talk to each other. I mean, everyone who plays a games for long enough becomes a designer because they keep criticizing them. It's like, so you have these discussions all the time with your friends about what a cool game would make. I don't think I'm speaking myopically from my own perspective here, I hear this from a lot of people, just the kinds of things that they'd like to improve about a game and so on. It's just because it's so hard. I mean, because you can't just start a computer game company, though, right? It's not like starting a band or starting to write novels or whatever. I mean, of course, those things take skill, but they're also, the entry is easy, comparatively, whereas you can't just start writing computer games. So computer games, there's way more ideas floating around than there are games. And so teaching design in that sense, or through museums and so on, it's like just seeing the good designs is a lot, is enough for a lot of people, I think, to get what they're going to get out of them. I mean, a lot of times now when I buy games, I play the game for you know, 5-10 minutes, and I kind of, unless there's some surprises later on or something that where it changes its modes completely, I kind of have the whole picture there, and I know what I'm going to get out of it, and so on. And in terms of translating that to an experience for someone else, seeing a video playthrough would be enough. Now, if you can't have a video playthrough, what kind of description could you have? Well, then you'd need to start getting into the language of gameplay or whatever words and so on. I'm not even sure that exists so well. Because I've never went to one of these places like DigiPen and all that stuff. I don't know what they teach there. You know,
I'm not familiar with DigiPen.
It's one of those places, one of those few universities that's kind of devoted to video game design and programming and stuff. Oh. And there are other places that have video game design courses and so on, mm-hmm. and programs. And I have no familiarity with that. So I don't know if there's a whole kind of academic parlance that's developed around video game and gameplay terminology and all that kind of thing. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And if I mean, because when you're getting to the point of where you're trying to preserve video games, trying to capture those ideas, I mean, if there's no common language, then you just have to kind of give a pretty verbose description. Like, for instance, take the game like those old games, not that old, but 80s, like the ones that inspired us the most, like Starflight and Seven Cities of Gold and Sword of Aragon and Mule and those games, where there's a lot there in those games that I haven't seen since. It just didn't make it or whatever. It just didn't, for some reason, it didn't percolate into a million sequels and a million spin-offs. But there's a lot of valuable things there, stuff that I'm, you know, indirectly, not just copying, but inspired our design enough that you see traces of it there. And then, you know, we're not, I wouldn't call us, you know, successful or anything, but we're still here. People enjoy our game. And those things are gone, though, those other games. I mean, you can kind of get them off Underdogs or something, and half the time they'll run and half the time they won't. And you really have to work your ass off to get an old game running sometimes. And that kind of, I mean, fortunately, the people that care the most are the people that are going to be motivated to do that. And fortunately, those games are still around, but some of them aren't. Some of the arcade games, especially the old arcade games that were in big boxes that were never anywhere else, you can't even play those. I mean, they have emulators and so on, but you don't necessarily have the ROMs for some of the old games and so on. And, of course, there's a whole legality issues there, too. So how do you get those games across to people? I mean, you can kind of talk about them and stuff, but... you know, it's, and so it's a matter of, so I mean, I'm not quite sure 100% what your perspective is here. If you're talking about catching games as they come out now, you catch them while they're here, and then how do you preserve them while you can currently play them? Or do you talking about going back and trying to recapture things that are already half gone? Right.
Yeah. I mean, it certainly seems like two different, kind of, approaches there. I think, more in the realm of, you know, looking at game creation, looking at that process and thinking about, what documents, what's made, what's important about that process that should be, archived or remembered or be able to be looked at down the line.
So yeah, it's difficult because even at the big places like I mean I don't know how typical Valve is, but they have 170 people there, and it's difficult to kind of capture the whole process, because what they had there was a room full of, say working on a project that had a room with 16 people in it. They all had computers. It's all just one room with people at computers. And they'd all have the game in some state. They'd be working on this or that part of it. But they could just yell ideas back and forth to each other, change the code, and then there's no more documentation, right? It's just it's that code part has changed. So if you want to get down to you know, how could you possibly document that without hidden microphones everywhere? You just need code snapshots, right? That's really the only documentation there is. A lot of stuff isn't written down. And what's written down is stuff like this, papers that my brother would have, and I would have with these tablets, where it's like you couldn't really figure out from this piece of paper what the heck we were doing. It's just all these doodles and lines and stuff where we're just kind of working out mentally what is going to go into the code later. But the problem with code snapshots is, you know, you'd need to have someone very diligent, and go through to really kind of get any information out of that, like what happened. It'd be kind of like handwriting analysis or something, just kind of trying to reverse this process to get into someone's head. So it's tricky in that way. I mean, that's why, I mean, kind of formalizing the language of game design, it seems like it would be easier to communicate, but there's really not going to be a formal language for game design in general, because I'm pretty much all of the game designers are self-taught right now. Yeah. I mean, there's no real formal, there's no film school, there's nothing like that. There's no music theory for it. There's a bit. I mean, I imagine I've seen some academic papers related to computer games, but it's still just starting off, and most people don't have a formal education related to game design who have gotten into it. So it's difficult.
Yeah. So this is kind of like an exploratory hypothetical question, but I mean, if there were a library of materials produced by people like yourself, a programmer and a developer and a designer, how would you or would you use that library?
So a library of materials concerning computer games that have been and describe various processes about their development and so on. And
yeah, but maybe it had code snapshots or design documents, if there were formal design documents, or bug databases, a snapshot of a bug database or something like that. Kind of like a library of all of these materials that have been made in creating this game.
So the question is, would I patronize such an establishment?
Yes.
Is that and would I find it useful? Why would I find it useful? That kind of thing. And the answer is absolutely, because the thing is, I mean, of course it depends on what's there, but the things you listed are all very useful, because the thing is, the flip side to the coin of, or whatever, it's not quite a flip side, but the complementary issue here for most designers being self-taught and so on, is that everyone kind of has giant holes in what they know. They don't know. You have to teach yourself how to do everything, right? So it's like, I didn't know how to do a bug database, and the thing I came up with, I basically came up with, right? It's like, and if there's more guiding principles there, then you find that incredibly useful. I mean, there are a ton of things I don't know how to do. I don't know how to do anything as far as internet technology with programming and stuff. And I had trouble enough setting up a Windows message loop and so on to get that kind of thing going. I had trouble with a lot of the technical aspects. And so seeing how people have previously solved problems computer-wise and development-wise and community interaction-wise, and just having a bunch of different ideas and all in one place is definitely a gold mine of information for people. And I mean, the problems are is that so much of it is kind of proprietary or whatever. There's a lot of difficulty getting that kind of information out of people, and I'm no exception. It's like, I mean, I talk to people about how I've done certain things, but certainly like dropping a Dwarf Fortress code bomb is out of the question. And so it's just a matter of I mean, you'd find different things useful, like how these people have archived their books and so on is all useful information. And now when it comes down to actual, I mean, that's sort of process decisions, like how they ran their business and their programming and how they kind of did that. Now in terms of the more kind of abstract stuff, you know, what would I be interested in? I don't really care how they design anymore because I'm comfortable with that. And I don't really think I need to change much about what I'm doing there. But like what kind of conversations they have. Although it's kind of interesting because you'd love to see like what processes gave rise to the games you don't like and stuff. It's like, how did that train wreck happen or whatever? That would be intriguing. But but also there's the there is the what was I going to say? Because it was something I was interested in. Yeah. Well, there are things I'm always interested in are hearing about games, especially older games, just because that's what it tends to be. But it's not really an age bias. I'd be interested in anything. Games that I haven't heard of, they're really interesting, where people have really come up with some intriguing decisions and so on. And so that kind of thing, which is the kind of thing that it would be up for a kind of librarian or curator to decide on, like what are the fascinating developments in video game design and stuff. There are always things that are interesting to see. They're really interested in seeing that kind of stuff, because even though ideas are pretty cheap in terms of what people can come up with way more ideas and so on, still the ones that are good, you don't always get exposed to. And it's just like I consider it a requirement for any computer game designer to play a ton of computer games, just like you'd want a musician to hear a lot of music or anything like that. It's good to go back and see those. To see those things, and then it comes down to, you know, what exactly do I want to see, right? It's like what would I want to do? I mean, ideally, you'd want to. I mean, in certain cases, because you're time constricted, the ideal situation is not even playing the game, because it might take a while to get through, and so on. You'd just want to. I mean, I'd want to see videos of the most important parts of the game, and I mean, even a paragraph describing the mechanics is enough sometimes. Just saying what happened and so on. But videos are a little bit better, because sometimes, especially in these after-action reports and stuff, people tend to embellish and invent. I mean, that's one of the great things about a computer game, when you can't see the source or people generally don't look at the source and so on, is that they'll fill in the gaps for themselves and give you credit for it. it's like there's a lot of times that happens in Dwarf Fortress, where they just kind of invent the mechanics themselves. And it's all cool because they're enjoying themselves, and you always come clean when they ask, you know. It's like, well, no, we don't actually have, you know, convection yet, but I'm glad you think we do. but just seeing that, seeing those games would be really cool. Because I remember, like I mentioned, Mule, for example, I didn't play that when it came out in like 1984 or whatever. But someone shared it with me in, say, 2007 or something. I'm like, that was really clever. I mean, that whole setup for that game was really interesting. A strange early multiplayer game that was really, you know, had a lot of things that were, you know, not only ahead of its time, but just never done again. And it was really fascinating. And I played the game, but just reading a article someone had put online about it was where they just described a playthrough of the game was enough to get everything out of it. I didn't really get much out of playing the game.
That's interesting.
So yeah, just describing, just having someone who's knowledgeable about computer games write about them is enough in a sense. I mean, it would be like the little blurb next to a painting in a museum or whatever. Sometimes you can learn some fascinating stuff.
Yeah, that's true. Well, thank you for your input. I'm out of all my questions, but you know, if there's anything else I should have covered or you want to talk about, then you know, just let me know.
Yeah, and if you have any follow-ups, just send me. I will reply.
Thank you. And I guess I should put in a plug for our video game archive that we're trying to start up here. If there is anything that you felt like putting there, it's something that we're starting up, and it's gotten a few materials. So, just to let you know about it. What's
so then on your website, or where is that?
Yeah, it's linked to on our website. If you go to preservegames.net, there's a link to the UT Video Game Archive, which is at the Center for American History, which is part of UT. And I think we've gotten some things from Richard Garriott and some other folks, you know, kind of boxes and a few design documents, things of that nature. So it's kind of a young archive.
Yeah, well, I guess I mean if I went there, and I mean I'd probably be able to expand on my answers a little bit to the last couple of questions. So I'll pop you an email if I drop by there.
Oh, great! Yeah, for sure. Okay. Well, okay. Thank you for your time. It's been a pleasure.
Cool. Okay. No problem. All right. Bye.